And please, let's give a warm welcome to our speaker tonight, Richard from the Happy Destiny Home Group.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I'm also just going to pass around this birthday card for Mike back there. Terrible Twos anniversary. Sign it if you wish. Thanks, Richard.
You're very welcome. Good evening, everybody. My name is Richard Brisson, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Richard.
I want to wish Mike a happy anniversary.
Thanks, sir.
Who'd have thought? Who'd have thought? What it was like, what I did, and what it's like now. I was raised in a military family, so I'm from nowhere, from wherever I am. And my father was a chief warrant officer in the United States Navy, and died sober. Was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and died sober. My mother was a part-time emergency room nurse and suffered from rather significant mental illness. And it's not an excuse, it's just something I was raised with. So what it was like, I'll give you kind of a basic drunkalogue, try to keep it pretty short. I usually never do this, but I am today because I don't know why, but I am. I've noticed over the years that drugs and alcohol, there's a lot. We have singleness purpose, I understand. I respect that. But my experience has also been that drugs and alcohol walk hand in hand frequently. So I will make one mention of it. And that's where I'll start. It was when I was 13 years old. Everything before then was a lot of just the usual stuff. But when I was 13 years old, a couple of guys came over to my house, and my mother was a nurse, and they had some heroin, and they didn't know how to inject it. And they thought, since I was the son of a nurse, that I, through osmosis or something, could help them. And my mother had the big glass syringes that you had to sharpen the needles, and my father gave her what she called liver shots. I don't know what the hell it was, but so anyway, I actually had a needle. And I didn't know what I was doing, but I faked it, and it worked out. And in payment for that, they gave me until they could have some more in services and learn how to shoot heroin. In payment, they would give me some. So I started shooting heroin when I was 13 years old. And the reason I say that is because that led to a lot of trouble for me. Most of the people that I ran with were older than I was, and had access to transportation and things that I didn't have. And I became an entrepreneur, let's put it that way. I found a way to make money, because once you take heroin, it tends to kind of want to stick with you a little bit. And I found a way to make money, and that also involved in those years in some rather risky behaviors, very violent, dangerous kind of stuff. And I enjoyed it. I loved it. Loved it my whole life. And so I got to experience a lot of things. And one of them was I got arrested when I was still a teenager, 16, for my entrepreneurship. And faced 160 years in penitentiary. But I made what I thought at the time was a really bright decision. Is okay, so I got to quit drugs because that's illegal, and I'm already trying to go to prison for drugs. And I drank when I was doing heroin too, but I switched completely over to that and to whiskey. I like whiskey, and so that's what I did forever until I came to AA. When I was about 16 years old, I was convicted of it. I didn't have to go, I never spent a day in jail. But I had a very long suspended sentence. And it was when Richard Nixon was having the war on drugs and this, that, and the other, so I was tried as an adult. It was what it was. So on my 16th birthday, my dad woke me up and said, "Richard, your rice bowl is broken. You are getting on a bus, Greyhound bus, and going to Wytheville, Virginia, Southwest Virginia, Mountains, Virginia. And you're going to live with in the basement of Father Murphy's church." He was a Catholic priest. I said, whatever. So I went to Wytheville. And But Father Murphy liked to drink probably more than I did. So I just hung out with the priest drinking for a while until the bishop found out I was living there, and he kicked me out. And the state of Virginia had a program for poor victims like me, where they would get together with farmers or whoever. I guess if you lived in a city, it was in a city. And they would pay for you, provide you a place to live. And I guess they fed me and stuff. I don't know what the hell they did, but anyway, I had a place to stay. So immediately, I went to work for a painter. He lived, there was two of them. The guy that owned the company, he was a drunk, and then the guy that lived upstairs with his wife. And where I lived actually was a tool shed. It had one room, it was a tool shed. It was a farm, there was a bunch of cows literally outside the door. And I went to paint with these guys. And things were working out pretty good. I mean, they drank as much as I did, but it wasn't a lot of money. And the guy that owned the company had a very unfortunate accident and lost his life. And so there was just two of us to paint. And this sounds greedy, but I was able to make more money. So as time went on, I had the morals of an alley cat. And I had it all, man. I had the guy upstairs' wife and alcohol and money, and you know, I was doing pretty good, I thought. And then the husband, the guy upstairs, sustained a rather significant head injury, and he's probably dead now, but he couldn't paint anymore because he couldn't breathe or walk or talk or anything. So I had a lot of the equipment. I kind of sold it. I don't know. I just had all the shit, you know. So I painted. And the reason I tell you this is because I had never graduated from high school. I got kicked out of my house when I was, you know, I don't know how old I was, 10th grade maybe or something. And I was painting a house for a dean of the college. And he said, Richard, would you like to go to college? Absolutely. Let's do it. He said, well, I will pay for this if you'll just, you know, be my painter. I said, all right. So I had been in college for 1 year when he found out that I wasn't, I had never graduated from high school. So he got a hold of the principal from Deep Creek High School. Can't remember his name, but anyway. I have a high school diploma. They use my college credits towards high school. So now that I got that, I'm trying to figure out, I got to do better than this. And I actually went to school and did very well and got a degree in something that I didn't want to do, you know. It was actually, taking care of people. I got a degree in psychology, and it was a degree that forced me into a situation where I had to have empathy and insight into human feelings, and I just did, everything I learned was mechanical. And I went to work at the state hospital, and after some period of time, old habits returned. I'm just drinking and just having a hell of a time, and I figured, well, I need to get married. That would be the answer to this. So I was taking another class in what they called the Morrison Building, and some little hillbilly girl gave me moon pie and RC cola, and that was it. And it wasn't but a few weeks later we were married. The night before we got married, I forgot her name. I had to ask my cousin her name was. I couldn't remember her name. And so we got married. And actually, that worked kind of for a while. She already had a child, and I thought, well, shit, you know, let's try this adult thing. I didn't know how to do that very well, but so I did. And it was working. I wasn't drinking. You know, I wasn't drinking, and I wasn't drinking for a while. Eventually, I went to work for, I had multiple felony convictions. God's got a sense of humor. There's a guy by the name of, Britt was his last name. Hell, I can't remember. He was from crack. He was the warden of the prison. And somehow, well, I know how somehow. Anyway, he knew of me because I worked in the state hospital. And he offered me a job as a prison guard. Hell, I had more freaking convictions than half the people in the prison. And I know this sounds like horseshit, but it's not. And so I went to work in the prison, and I loved it. I would go if I had to do all over again. I probably stayed there, because you go inside, and they lock you in, and it's to everybody else. It's I'm locked up in this place with these people that have done all these things, and it's the safest I ever felt. I loved being in that prison. I loved it. And I got to fight every single day. I got to learn incredibly inappropriate behavior. A bunch of sociopaths. People that I could really, and I mean every word I'm saying, you know, that I could really relate to, that had no sense of remorse or conscience. It was great. I loved it. And but while I was there, I needed to make more money. They didn't make much money back then. And my mother had been an ER nurse. When I left here, I was in a lot of trouble, obviously. And I had a huge resentment against all law enforcement and so on and so forth. So my plan was to be an ER nurse, like my mother had been, and come back here. And then these people that had treated me so badly, there'd be a reckoning. There'd be a reckoning. And it made perfect sense to me. And so I went to school, like, you know, alcoholics will go to any length to do something. And so I went to school for years. Worked at the penitentiary, went to school during the day and worked penitentiary at night. Nobody in the state of Virginia then had ever been able to get a nursing license with a felony conviction. Well, Bob Britt, that's what his name was. Bob knew Eleanor J. Smith, I still remember her name, who was the executive secretary of the State Board of Nursing, and said, I got this guy, blah, 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 and he sold it. And she said, I will let him take the courses, and if he passes this, then I'll make a decision then whether or not he can take a state board exam. So I stayed soberish, you know, for that period of time. But I didn't get in any trouble. And damn if I didn't graduate. And they said, oh yeah, you know, you can do that. So I went to the John Marshall Hotel in Richmond. Back then there was no computer, this, that, and the other. And there's like 1,000 women and 4 men. And so you can imagine. And it was, the tests then were 2 days long because they didn't have computers. And they had a bar, and I took the first day of tests and did real well, but then I hit the bar that night. Mm-hmm. And a lot of weird stuff happened. I won't even get into it, but the next day, with a huge hangover, I did it, took the test. I'll be damned if I didn't pass the thing. I was the first. I'm bragging, but it was pretty impressive. I was the first person in the state of Virginia with multiple felony convictions to get. So now I got this nursing license, and I told my wife, you know, if we go back down where I lived, and she'd obviously been down here, then I can make more money, and I have my plan in motion, and I did. Back then, you know, if you were male, you worked in the emergency room, the operating room, ICU, whatever. That's just the way it was. So I immediately went to work in the emergency room, and I really had every intention of going through with my plan, you know. But what happened was that I became very good at what I did. You know, I've been on the other end of trauma, and now I'm actually, you know, like saving people that have been shot and this, that, and I loved it. I loved every bit of it. Loved the chaos. I loved every bit of it. And the cops, they got to like me, you know, and they started to treat me with respect. But I had them by, and this is a medical term, I had them by the short hairs, because they knew that this is the face they're going to see if they get hurt or they get shot. So it flipped in my demented brain. It flipped. Now I'm in charge of them, and now I could also, if I, give you a nickel for every time I got stopped by the police in multiple cities, drunk, driving, and they would, one time they caught me going eastbound on the westbound lane of 264 into the tunnel. I had left the FMP, it's the middle of the night. I had the window rolled down, Christmas party, I think it was. There's like 10 police cars in back of me. And they finally got me stopped, but they, all they did was put a rookie in my 1976 Vegas station wagon and brought me home. So anyway, that and that's the way it was for years after that. I drank and I got away with a lot of shit, and that pretty much covers that. The details don't matter. Somewhere along the line, something changed. And it was right around 1990 when my dad had mesothelioma, had a terminal disease, and was going to die. And I don't know what happened, but it just, everything got worse. And my pathology got worse, my alcoholism got worse. I started having blackouts every single time. And when I had blackouts, I would do really, really weird stuff, you know. And so the last several years, he died. And then this last several years of my drinking were unbelievable, just unbelievable, the things. You know, just trust me when I tell you, it was just damn, you know. So I went to, and my dad had been in AA and died sober, and it never dawned on me. Never dawned on me to go to AA, like that was even an option. I was surrounded by a bunch of people with multiple letters after their names, very smart people, and they were useless to me. And all of a sudden, I know what I did. I went to the Catholic Church, and it was locked, and I made entry. And when I got in, the priest caught me, you know, and he was hysterical because I had made entry into his church. And I was there because I wanted to talk about, I got a problem with alcohol, you know, maybe you can help me. And he's calling the police, and they're, hell of a mess. But the reception at the lady or whatever you call her over there, she run the priest off and called me in there. And she said, Centenary, it was right across the street. She said, keep it short, she had, there's right across the street at Centenary, there's a Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And as soon as she said Alcoholics Anonymous, I said, oh shit, my dad was in that. And it made me think of, how did I miss this? My dad was, when he was in the throes of alcoholism, was one of the most miserable people on the planet. The day he died, and I say this with all honesty, he was a wonderful, wonderful man. This is what Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer. He, with my children and the things that I've learned that I think I've kind of passed on to my grandchildren, he taught me so much, you know. He showed up on Thanksgiving when I didn't know I got sober, with a 400 miles away, with a turkey. The hell's this guy bringing me a turkey for? And he told me about, you know, his alcoholism, and was making amends, essentially, is what he was doing. Well, eventually when we moved back down here, my dad's sober. So I got to experience my dad being sober while I was down here. And it was wonderful, wonderful. I diverged. But anyway, so I forgot where I was at, so I'll get in the middle of still being drunk for the last 3 years that I was drunk. I go to the church, make entry into the church. So I went to Centenary in July of whenever, and picked up a white chip. And when I got off work the next day, I was drunk. And so the following July, a year later, I went to Centenary and I picked up a white chip. And a year later, you know, the next day I was drunk. A year later, I went back to Centenary and picked up a white chip. And that's the last chip I ever picked up in 1993. So what happened? I don't know. I don't know. I guess I had to get miserable enough. I could not drink was the problem, you know. And all the stuff that I read about and all the info, it was all useless. And there was a welder with about a 10th grade education. I walked into, I eventually ended up over at crack. I got sober at crack. And I knew how to work an entry aortic balloon pump, but I couldn't remember my name half the time. And so I had a little thing with a pencil and I would write stuff down, you know, what they were saying. And what they were telling me was, so this is a, what did I do? I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, what I did. And I went in there willing to believe that I had no clue what was going on. And I was so miserable. It's a helpless, hopeless feeling. And you know, by working in an emergency room, I gained respect. I gained a lot of positive things, and I was able to do something with that. One was, I got my rights restored, got the right to bear arms back. You went through the ATF, where you had to get a background check, like the military background check, your neighbors, your employers, everybody else. And I even got permission from the ATF to transport explosives, which I was So I came out of this conviction with more rights than when I went into it. Yeah, but anyway, so there were some good things that happened. But in AA, it was like there was no other choice. And I'm looking around in there, and I felt... I'm looking around like, what the hell is this all about? And I really don't remember the first few months of it. I just knew that if I was to have any chance to be happy, any chance to be able to function, I was just so sick and tired. I would go from one hospital to the other, try to work two different hospitals, so it's 16 hours. And because then I'm not going to drink, but damn it. Like if I'm working out at Overseas, and I lived in Chesapeake then, I had, you know, a fifth vodka underneath the seat. I could not stop is the thing. So I'm listening to these guys, you know, and there was a bunch of old guys. And they were pretty tough, you know. And I needed to find somebody I don't mean to seem like really badass, but I couldn't intimidate, you know, somebody that didn't blink, especially with some of the details of my history of my life. And I found that. Okay, now what do I do? So I got a home group, Product Center, and I went to meetings every day. And then I got a sponsor. And in getting a sponsor, what happened was he introduced me to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And said, this is what we're going to do. And if I deviate from this, fire me. Because this is where it comes from. So I started working these steps. And I cleaned a lot of smoking then, and I cleaned ashtrays. And I got pissed. I'm like, you know what? Because I always think I'm the brightest guy in the room. I still do. And I'm thinking, I'm the brightest guy in the room here, and I'm cleaning these friggin' ashtrays. That's one of the number one reasons I got sober. Is that responsibility, is that humility, you know, that knocking it down a notch. And Richard, if you know, that's God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. That's what I did. I cleaned ashtrays and I made coffee and I did, Craddock was big on service work. I got involved in whatever and started working through these steps. You know, I was taught that, you know, the first two steps I kind of did out there. I'm powerless over alcohol. I'm the one that decides that. If I had a nickel for everybody told me I was, you know, you're powerless over, you're a drug, you're powerless over alcohol. It's useless information to me. But when I realized I cannot not drink and my life is unmanageable, I decide that, not you. I know that I have a history this long of all kinds of weird shit, you know? But that doesn't count. I've got to realize that my life is unmanageable. And then be willing to believe that there's something. I'm looking at the altar boy thing back there. I was even in, that's a story unto itself also. But I was an altar boy for a while. I don't know what that has to do with anything. But a higher power. So I had been to church, you know, and heard about God and these things. But be willing to believe that there's something that could help me. Something greater than myself was kind of later. Something out there that can help me. Okay, I'll try. The third step I did with my youngest daughter. And in the doctor's opinion, it talks about the obsession and the compulsion, the alcoholism being that obsession to drink. I cannot not drink. And the third step, the third step prayer on page 63, here's this operating procedures of how to do Alcoholics Anonymous, Richard, do this with somebody. So I did, read that step three with my daughter and meant it. And I also read that page every day. And I've been doing that for a long, long time. But, people can believe or not believe, but I can just give my experience and then everybody can do whatever the hell they want to do. Is that day, the obsession to drink left me. Now, I stood in front of that mirror every morning. I'll never do this again. But by 10 o'clock, my brain was telling me, you know what? It wasn't that bad. And the last several years of my drinking, it was like that every single day. I did a third step on my knees with my daughter, and the obsession to drink left. You can take that to the bank. And then it tells me what else to do. I need to, obviously there's something wrong with me, and all this other stuff that people told me about was of no use. So an inventory of characteristics that I have that are out of bounds. And I had some that were, and still do, probably all as well. I have some that are way out of bounds. And some occur more often than others. But I learned that concept. Okay, so here, do this inventory. And it's in the big book of how to do the inventory. But I did it, I got kind of a primer from my sponsor. This is what I did, so do this. We don't have to talk about the fifth step. Just get it down on paper. And then I had a concern that if I, my business dealings of my youth trained my mind to never trust anybody at all. Sometimes with the penalty of losing my life. And I think to myself, if I say this, some things, to another human being and he gets jammed up and tells the cops, somebody's going to stick, I think, now they were lethal injection, and somebody's going to stick a needle in my arm. And that concerned me. And what I discussed it, with my sponsor, and he said, if I were to divulge that, why am I even here? I'll lose my sobriety. I'll lose my ability to be of maximum service to you or anybody else. And I believed it. I believed him. This is a big deal. I believed him. So I did what I thought was, it turned out I missed a couple things, but I did a thorough inventory. And then I went over, got a time, and went over and sat down with him and went through it. And it became rather evident quickly that there was kind of a pattern to this, so it wasn't as difficult as I thought. But I left that fifth step meeting with my sponsor feeling like a million pounds were just raised off my shoulder. And it's like taking physical therapy. If you ding something up, you gotta go to physical therapy. And once you learn the process of physical therapy, you can continue to do that in the future when you screw something else up later. Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of learning how to do an inventory. Because once I learned how to do that, A, it worked. And B, that was my answer. That was my solution to how to, at least when something comes up, to know what to do. And I learned that as time went on, and I was sober for more than 15 minutes, sometimes things would come up and I would be able to handle it just in my head. More frequently though, I needed to write it down. I am resentful at, or this, that, and the other. And I had to do that. And then I was either, if I had no relief, I'm on the phone with the sponsor, we're talking about it. So it catches everything, it catches everything. I'll give you an example. I was very angry with a young man from years before. He had injured a family member of mine. And I had already, and I got out of it because I knew the cops. I'd already drove my truck through his house. I had already drove his truck into a tree. I tried to do bad things to him. The point is that that was the breath of my anger. It was a terminal anger. And one day something happened. And anyway, bad things happened. But it survived the incident, and I didn't go to jail. Years later, so after that, I'm at Frank's truck shop, and riding my motorcycle, got a couple buddies with me, and I go in, and I see him sitting right over there. And I didn't have my pistol. I said, well, we'll kill that boy. So I went to go out to get the pistol, and in between point A and point B, I wasn't as angry. You know, I lost my anger a little bit. So I figured I'm just going to stick it. I'm still going to kill him, but I'm going to stick him. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't seem as malicious, even though it's probably more malicious. It didn't seem as bad. Welcome to my head, you know. So, and I got, but I didn't have a knife. So I borrowed it from my sponsor. And so I went in there to do this, and then I looked and I realized, that's the wrong guy. It wasn't him. It's the wrong guy. You know, it's the wrong guy. But now, in my head, I'm a punk and I'm embarrassed. Because everybody in here knows the whole story, which they don't, unless they have ESP. But I got to do something. So I give this poor guy a ration and blah, 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 this, that, and the other. And just ignored everybody. Went out and got on my motorcycle. So did everybody else. And we're riding 90 miles an hour down Military Highway. When I finally realized, okay, Richard, you did it again. So I threw out the anchor, got it all cranked down, this, that, and the other. And just, I knew what I needed to do was an inventory right now, right this second. Did it out in where Grassfield High School is. And several of the guys come over, like, wanted to talk to me about that, which was a real bad mistake. But my sponsor was like, just let him be, let him be, let him be. And I did an inventory, and I knew what it was. And the what I was willing to do was, he asked me a question. He said, what would you do if this guy came into Craddock and stuck out his hand and said, I'm an alcoholic and I need some help. And this was God, that intuitive thing that happens. Understand, I wanted to kill this guy the day before. And then, I knew intuitively that I wouldn't be able to help him, but I told my sponsor I would find one of you guys to try to help him. And I actually meant it. It wasn't, it was kind of spooky, you know, it was weird. And that, if he was drowning, I doubt I'd throw him a thing, you know, but at least I don't have to actively, you know. Passively, maybe, but not actively. But I learned that this really works. You know, me and God worked out a deal that I had a characteristic that was way out of bounds, and he relieved me of that pressure. And then the sponsor said, what would you do? It was kind of like a test for me. I don't think he meant it that way, but I learned that day that, yeah, you know, there's something to this. And so I've had many other instances after that where I've learned that Alcoholics Anonymous and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous will provide that answer. So now I know how to do an inventory. I know what to pray for. That's what it plugs me into. And then the amends was, you know, it just wasn't rocket science. But I learned something else as time went on that was massively important, and that's the debt. That I was given a very precious gift, and by a lot of people who spent a lot back in the day. You know, I remember, Steve remember, you know, after the meeting, you're out there in the parking lot until 1 o'clock in the morning for me, hanging over the bed of an 81 Chevrolet pickup truck. Because we're too stupid to get in the truck and turn on the heat, you know. But just doing AA stuff, the meeting after the meeting. And And all them old guys, you know, a lot of them like, just irritated the shit out of me, you know. But they would say things, and it was accurate. It was true. You know, they would have the cojones to, you know, do the right thing, to say, Richard, whoa, you okay? And they could see through me. They could see me, you know. In the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, when the alcoholic sit down on the bed with that drunk and talking to him, and he knew the same thing that I knew, that these two guys, we are people that won't usually mix. And there's a lot, and that's very, very true. And that's what was happening to me. So I learned then that there's more to it. You know, it's that faith without works is dead. Is that I needed to do service work. You know, the GSRs and ADC, and you know, this, that, workshops, this, that, drive people to places and do a bunch of stuff that I did not want to do. To this day, I hate it when people, they give you that look, and you know that they're going to want ask you to sponsor it. You know, I'm retired. I could sit on my ass all day long, and nobody's going to, you know, hit me with a stick. And it's like, you want to use up my time. Mercy. So I learned how important that debt is. I've been sober for a while, and what it's like now was, you know, is life. It's never ending journey. It truly is. Of when early in sobriety, things were what they were, and I reacted to and took in what I took in, and I learned as that journey went along. And as Jack Carr used to always say, who was somebody that irritated the shit out of me, but every time he said that, but God bless him for saying it, is the road gets narrower. And it does. You know, you first come in, your ass is falling off, and it's just, give me everything. And you get down here, and it gets kind of tight. And as time went on, I had some things come up that my shelf life got shortened down a little bit. So it became important to me to, you got to understand how much of a sociopath I am. You know? But it became apparent to me as time went on, I didn't always have to be there. I started getting excited about second year anniversaries. Tickles the shit out. And truly does. And I mean that. Mechanically, I can say a lot of things, but that's actually an emotion. And I learned that that debt is so important that I learned other things about how to be of maximum service to God and my fellow man. It comes right out of the book. That's the goal. And I know how to do that. And I'll give you an example. And I give this example all the time because it's a big example to me. It's important to me. It's me talking to myself, doing this tonight. I was married for 46 years. My wife decided to pack her sea bag and leave. And then, which was very inconvenient because we had a very large house with a lot of shit and this, that, and the other. And it was just very inconvenient and very expensive. But 2 weeks later, my brother called me on the phone, my youngest brother, who'd been coming, at least one person in here knows it, had been fighting this for decades, 20 years. And he called me crying. And Richard, I'm drunk again. And I said, well, Joe, the same thing I always did. I'll pick you up at such and such time. We'll go here. We'll do that. And he said, okay. And he said, I love you. That's the last words he said to me. I said, okay. 20 minutes later, now this is in the middle of trying to get my 5-bedroom house unloaded to sell, so that my wife, whose name I forgot when we got married, can go back to Appalachia. And I got a phone call from Joe's wife, and he said, Joe just shot himself in the head. And I knew his weapon, he had a .357 mag. I knew that the outcome was. So I went over there, and he was pretty dead. And it was devastating, but I could keep it in the channel, you know. And I realized from that, I'm still to this day, I'm very sad about that. I'm sad. I didn't know that. I thought that was a wimpy thing, that you're not allowed to do that. It's not. It's not. That is what you call emotion. That's a human emotion, which I'm not real good with, you know. So I'm still to this day sad. But what I learned from that, the example is, okay, Richard, the debt is, it's called survivors of suicide. I didn't try to commit suicide. I don't know what it is, but it's a group of people. And so I went to that, you know. And I know it has nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous, but guess what? It has everything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. So I went to that for me. And after a few meetings, I got it. And I'm thinking, you know what? I'm pretty much cured about that. I don't need to do this anymore. Mm-hmm. When I realize you selfish son of a bitch, these people, there's new people. It's like AA coming in that door, whose son just hung himself or whatever, you know. And I realized I have a debt to be of maximum service to God and my fellow man. So that's something else that I do. I do things that I really give it my hit it with my best shot. Right after that, I had a heart attack, but that's not the story. The story is my brother, other brother, was really upset about Joe. Best times we ever had was us three riding motorcycles. I'm in cardiac rehab, you know. I've sold all my motorcycles. He gives me a motorcycle, and I'm like, and he wants to ride to Utah and Arizona. All right, let me get a little bit more cardiac rehab in here. I took a leave of absence from cardiac rehab. I took a ride out to Utah and Arizona and this, that, and the other. That's not the blow about. What is it, the point of that is right, wrong, or different, it doesn't matter. It's, to me, I was being of maximum service to my brother. That's the one thing that he needed from me. And it was, to me, it was worth my life to be able to stand in the breach and be there for him. And I just had a couple more procedures done. And now he told me I want to ride out to Idaho and Montana. I start cardiac rehab the 10th. So, you know, we're going to do this all again. But that's the importance of what taught me is the debt, so I can be of service to him. Look, the grandkids, if they're having marvel things and baseball stuff, whatever, I don't give a shit what they're doing. I'm there. I'm there. And it's for them, but it's also selfishly, it's for me. It's because of that debt. If God gave me a chance to be sober and relatively happy, and to be able to face both good things and pretty significant adversity, then I'm going to do my part to share that message. Okay? So the way it used to be was, if somebody comes in here and firebombed this room, as long as I made it out, I didn't give a shit. I've made changes in my life where I actually care about other human beings now. And what that does for me is let me care about other human beings, and it makes me feel better. I don't need to drink. I don't need to change my perception, because I don't have to concern myself. If my dad died sober, had a terminal disease, and he said, I remember asking him, Dad, you can drink, you can do that, you can do anything. You're going to be dead in like 3 months. And he said, all he said was, Richard, it's really important to me that I die sober. And I couldn't understand it. I understand that, every word of that now. And before he died, well, there towards the end he couldn't do much, but he was still going to meetings and until he couldn't drive anymore. He was still driving people to meetings. And it was, and people that some of us have known over the years have that same story. You know, they give to so many people, change so many lives, including their own, and die sober and relatively happy. There was a guy, it was at the Naval Hospital, and I'd known him for decades, and really a great guy. I walked over there with Ernie. I thought I was going to have another heart attack. Naval Hospital, do that with cardiomyopathy sometimes. Anyway, I went in there, and you know, all the stripes are there. There's people everywhere. I can't breathe. And Frank's kind of obtunded and unconscious, and his wife's there, and everybody's there. And Frank, he's deaf as a rock anyway. So I, you know, make a hole. If you, I kind of joke about it. I don't visit people. I don't visit people in the hospital. But if you see me in the hospital, because I usually get dead by the next day. You know, I wait until the last minute. I'm pretty good at telling that. So it's just been an ongoing joke, which Frank would have understood. So when I came in there, you know, I'm kind of shaking him a little bit. They look down on that when people are, you know, I'm shaking him a little, and I'm hollering at him because I know he's deaf. I called his name. No, Richard, I'm here visiting you. You're screwed, you know. Well, all these people were like, and there's to his wife, you want us to get him out of there? And, you know, the corner putting their hands on me and everything else. And his wife understood and said, leave him alone. Frank had a little bit of a smile. He was dead, you know, like 4 hours later. But you know what I mean? He died the right way, you know? And we just had a good time. And there's many, many people that I've done that with. So what Alcoholics has to offer, if I do the work, because if I come in here, if I lie to you, it doesn't matter. It's just a lie to you. I can't lie to me, you know. And if I do the same things that I did at the beginning, and if I share that message, repay that debt, then I'll probably stay sober another day. And the other thing that I've got is what I told you about. It's new to me in the past several years, but it's new, is that feeling of happiness inside. You know, when I see people that are sober now, you know, and I meet them at the beginning when all the world's falling apart and, you know, the whole story. And then I see him out here, you know, and things have worked out however they've worked out, but they're relatively happy and still sober. It just tickles the shit out of me, you know, and that's just a miracle. So I don't know if I covered everything. So that's what it was like. That's what I did, and I'm relatively happy now. And that's it. Thank you.